This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series. Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahval's video and podcast series. Today, my guest is from Boston, Massachusetts, Gerard Libaridian. Gerard Libaridian is one of the top figures to speak about the current Nagorno-Karabakh crisis, a former senior minister of foreign affairs of Armenia, also a senior advisor to then president of Armenia, Levonter Petrosyan, and historian and politician. And also he was a director of modern Armenian history in University of Michigan, now based in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Gerard.
Thank you, Yavuz.
Our acquaintance, friendship, if I may call it, goes way back to 1990. So during the interview, I may call, I hope, Jurair.
Certainly.
So you have the great memory of what happened on Karabakh conflict, also on Armenian-Azeri relations. And it would be extremely important to hear your views of where things are at the moment, the context, and where things are heading, to be heading also. Also, the third player, Turkey, in this conflict, it would be really interesting to hear what you think about the current situation. So let's start with the basic question. Then we can develop the conversation into deeper areas. Which part is the winner of the current situation? Russia? Or is there a winner? Or
right. What happened on November 14, the ceasefire agreement that put an end to the fighting, proved the following. That to begin with, Azerbaijan was able to get 4 of the 7 districts that were occupied by the Armenian forces. And also the town of Shushi or Shusha in the Azerbaijani parlance. So in that respect, Azerbaijan is the major winner. It was also able to extract a price for signing the ceasefire. That is the promise by Armenian forces that the Armenian forces will withdraw from the other 3 districts. And the agreement also, without saying so directly, kind of affirms what the international community has been saying, that the Karabakh is part of Azerbaijan. That is, indirectly, it establishes sovereignty over Karabakh, whole of Karabakh.
That's your reading.
That's my reading of it. Mm. And Azerbaijan is in a position to impose that. And it was supported by Turkey, of course, and supported by Russia. President Putin of Russia, was interpreting it yesterday or 2 days before, and he said, it is very obvious that this is the situation, that Russia did not interfere in the fighting, which some Armenians expected, and maybe others too. It did not intercede because the fighting was in the sovereign territory of another nation, which would be Azerbaijan. So that is not different from what had been said before by the Minsk group co-chairman, that includes France, Russia, US, and by just about every country in the world, that says Karabakh is part of Azerbaijan. Now, in what status, with what status, that's a different issue. That would be negotiable from their point of view. But there's no country or mediator or any interested country that said any different. So Putin reaffirmed that, and that comes out also from some of what you need to read in the text. Mm-hmm. For example, with regard to the Lachin Corridor, although it will be manned by Russian peacekeepers, but in a different point. The sentence of point six says that it will be under the jurisdiction of. So if Lachin is controlled by Russia and Azerbaijan, then there's really no chance of anything else happening there, any other solution. And with regard to that, President Aliyev has said that what he imagines will be the status of Armenians is a kind of cultural autonomy and not geographic. So my interpretation of that is extraterritorial minority rights. That is, if Armenians are in Qarabağ, they will have the same rights as, they say, Armenians in Turkey. That is, there's no territorial definition of Armenians, but there's an ethno-religious definition of Armenians. So they can have their church, their newspaper, they can have their books and language.
Schools.
Schools, you know, it doesn't say anything, but this is what I'm imagining. But there will be direct control and there will not be a political or territorial dimension to that autonomy. So this is what I'm reading. So in this sense, Azerbaijan is the major winner. Russia has been able to do a number of things. Number one, it was able to keep the US and France basically out of the final negotiations on the ceasefire that worked.
Can we say that Russia, especially US, did not really become interested to get involved? Maybe France, yes, but not
France
not
was Russia. Very interested, but the US got interested at one point. There are two issues with the US. One is that there was an election.
Yes, distraction.
Rather, three issues. One is there's an election, and it was a very, very tough election in terms of the emotions and mental energies of people. So there was not much room to deal with other real issues. Secondly, President Trump is very enamored with President Putin. And for some time now, he has functioned in a way that allows Russia to do whatever it wants in terms of the way it defines its national interests. So Trump has been very tolerant of Russia and Putin's behavior. The third is the larger American withdrawal from the world, which has something to do with Trump, but Trump's style of withdrawal, which is abrupt, without consultation, but the general withdrawal had been evident before. It's there since the war in Iraq, which proved to be a disaster. This is my interpretation, that the in the last few years, even before Trump, when the US was looking at the South Caucasus, it did not have the major investment in interest and resources, that diplomatic resources, that it did before. That may be because America has become much more independent in energy resources. It's now become an exporter of energy rather than importer. Although we import much, but it is also an exporter, particularly with the rise of natural gas. So these three factors have indicated that the U.S. does not have the same interest, maybe does not have the resources. So, and Europe, of course, in foreign policy is fragmented. And COVID proved that in other policies, too, there were national borders with different policies and not a European border.
Apparent divisions on many issues, yes.
Right. So, and with UK withdrawal from the EU and so they have their own problems.
So back to what you said about Russia. You said Russia did several things. First, they distracted. Yes.
It has been the goal of Russian policy in the South Caucasus to consolidate its presence beyond Armenia. And Garapal had been the vehicle through which it would return. Returning to Georgia is impossible. But returning to Azerbaijan was something possible. And I think in the Russian strategic thinkers, if they were able to get into Azerbaijan, then they could do something also with Georgia. But to have Armenia in their pocket and Azerbaijan with having some influence there, then it will weaken Georgia's leanings toward the West. Now, and since 1993, when I was the chief negotiator for Garapal, we had the Minsk group negotiations, but we also had Russian proposals that were brought by Russian diplomats secretly to the two sides, to the three sides. And although Russia was part of the Minsk group, they also had their own negotiations. That ended when Russia became co-chair, okay, of the Minsk group. Now, at that time, I wanted to understand fully what Russia wanted. And I instructed my staff. I had a small staff, but very brilliant girls and boys, right? And I had trained them. So I asked them, here are the Minsk group proposals that have been approved by Russia. Here are the proposals that are by Russia. And I want you to study these and tell me what is the consistent point in these. Okay?
Good question.
What is consistent that never changes? Everything else may change, but one thing does not change. And my suspicion was confirmed. They want Lachin under Russian control. Okay? Because if you have Lachin, you control supply of anything to Garapa, right? And that means, and you can foment trouble, and you can destabilize Azerbaijan and Armenia. Okay, you can manipulate. It's like hot water and cold water. You can open and close.
Yes.
And that was obvious to me. But there was another thing which my people did not think of. And then I explained to them, when you look at documents, you don't only look as to what is there, but what should have been there and is not there. Okay. And what was not there is any reference to the future status of Garapal. And look what happened now. With this ceasefire, there is no discussion of status, although it is implies that it is Azerbaijan. And Lavrov and Putin, both of them interpreting the ceasefire agreement, said, we don't have to decide the status now. We have time for that in the future. We should not have deadlines, okay? So these two points, 93, already were clear in my mind. And even recently, talking with international experts, they didn't think Russia would do what it did. And I said, no, it will do it. It will find a way of doing it. Now, so in this respect, Russia is a winner as well. Although, whether this will be a long-term strategic shift or not remains to be seen. What that depends on is if there are enough Armenians of Garapal to return to Garapal. A lot of civilians came to Armenia, right?
Right.
But the war started. So if they don't return in large numbers, because they don't trust the ceasefire, because they fear, their psychological fear of Azeris, the Azeris will come back to Garapal. The government of Azerbaijan will make sure they come back to Shusha. And they come back to maybe other villages.
They will get settled there.
And the mistrust is so deep in both that Armenians may still not feel comfortable going back.
Some have returned. There were some numbers today from Moscow, 600 or 700 having returned.
There's some buses who are taking them. The question is, will there be in enough numbers to have still a Garapal problem? Okay. That's the first question in my mind. Is there still a Garapal problem? Or will Azerbaijan, through various means, make it difficult for Armenians to return or to feel safe or to feel that they have any kind of a status?
Right.
So there will be some who will return. If, and Russia will be interested in Armenians returning, because if there are not enough Armenians, there's no reason for Russian peacekeepers. Peacekeepers for what? Right?
Right.
So this is the key question in my mind. Russia's position is somewhat tenuous. And I just read that Azerbaijan is getting ready to accept Turkish troops. Maybe not around Garapal, but Turkish troops nonetheless. And the parliament just approved it in Turkey.
Right. Right. What is your reading into that? How deeply will Turkey be settled in the region in general?
Oh, it will be.
And also whether or not it will have any fingerprints in Nagorno-Karabakh, militarily or in other ways?
No, I don't think militarily it will make, because Azerbaijan no longer needs that much. They have established, although there are some voices in Armenia talking about getting ready for another war, that will not happen. And the more they talk about in Armenia or Artsakh about another war to recover what they had, the less chances they have of succeeding in recreating something that is an Armenian Karabakh. I don't think Azerbaijan will allow that. And it will have Turkey's support. But I think the question was, Turkey expected to be part of the ceasefire agreement. Mm-hmm. Russia kept Turkey out. However, there may have been a tacit understanding or an understanding of which Russia was not part, that, okay, the ceasefire is Russian, peacekeepers are Russian, but there will be a center that will watch the ceasefire, and Turkey will be part of that.
Right.
But that Azerbaijan is an independent country. Azerbaijan can invite Turkish troops to its country, and no one can stop it. So whether this was an understanding at the time of the signing of the ceasefire agreement, or it was done separately between Azerbaijan and Turkey, I don't know. But Turkey's silence when the ceasefire was signed and they were kept out leads me to think that this was an understanding at least between Azerbaijan and Turkey. Mm-hmm. That, okay, you're not part of the ceasefire, but we'll bring you anyway.
Which the Russians may not like.
Of course they will not like, but how can you stop them? How can Russia stop? Is it going to fight the Turkish troops in Azerbaijan or the Azerbaijani army?
So we may say perhaps that Turkey played its cards very well, very smartly.
Well, Turkey played its cards very well, of course. So Turkey has gained at least a step beyond its relations with Azerbaijan, but there's that center, right, for ceasefire management, of which Turkey is officially part, number one. Number two, its defense relations with Azerbaijan have been deepened now. So that's number two. And number three, if Turkey comes in, with an army, even if it's a small platoon, it means something, of course. But the point is, there's a larger point as far as Turkey is concerned. And this is my interpretation. And I'm trying to test myself. And the more I think about it, there must be some truth in this. Now, Karabakh was the card Russia held for its excuse to come into South Caucasus. Correct?
Right.
Now, but Russia, Karabakh was being destroyed and Russia did nothing. Why? If Karabakh had been lost to Armenia.
You're talking about the Russian delay in getting involved. Okay.
Right. If Russia was allowing it to happen, then why was it allowing it to happen? Was it because it didn't know what to do? Was it surprised, as some people think, and didn't know how to react? Or possibly the following, that Karabakh does not have the same significance as it did before. It could be used to bring Russians to Azerbaijan, but if it's Turkey that's coming in, and that means a successful diplomatic strategic drive to detach Turkey from the US and from NATO, mm-hmm. and then Azerbaijan and Turkey becomes a partner in the strategic, if that means having thrown out the US and Europe for good, and Azerbaijan that owes Russia for not interfering in the Karabakh war itself, and a Turkey also understanding Russia allowed Karabakh to be taken by Azerbaijan. So we have three friends. That is, Putin achieved a larger goal of, number one, getting rid of the West from the South Caucasus. Number two, detaching to a large extent Turkey from the West and NATO and the US. Mm-hmm. And so in order to keep Azerbaijan out of NATO and out of the influence of the West, Russia and Turkey and Azerbaijan get closer, but Turkey is closer to Russia than to the US. Mm-hmm.
And also it is now opening a territory for itself, right, into the Southern Caucasus. Right. So in case things turn sour between US and Turkey.
Right. And Turkey does not represent what it used to represent 10 years ago, 15 years ago. The second strongest army in NATO, in full alignment with Western interests in everywhere. Mm-hmm. That's shattered. So the Turkey is not as dangerous as it used to be. This is my interpretation. Mm-hmm. So this is what Putin got, which is as important. Now, whether this is everlasting or not, I don't know. If Erdogan is changed, there's a new regime, will they follow? Usually, such major alignments do not change easily.
Correct.
Okay? That is, these have something to do with mentalities, not just the persons or political parties. Just as in the United States, it's true that Biden will change a number of things. Biden will get into the Paris Accords. Biden wants to get back into the Iran Accords and environment, etc. But Biden will not be able to change what is the more fundamental change in American policy of getting out of running the world. It doesn't have the resources anymore, and it doesn't have the appetite. It is an empire that is declining, and that's what will remain. It doesn't matter who it is. In fact, when the Democrats criticized Trump for pulling troops out of Germany and diminishing its presence, it wasn't on the principle of withdrawal. It was on the method that he did, by not discussing issues with our partners, with our allies. That's what the criticism was.
I see.
Obama had wanted to get out of Iraq. Obama had wanted to get out of Afghanistan. So that was a general trend. It was a difference in style and in respect with our allies and our commitments. So I think even if Erdogan goes, who's going to come? Bahçeli? Well, Bahçeli is in full support of sending troops to Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm. Right? Of course. If not so, leading the entire involvement.
There are things that Erdogan is doing better than the nationalists would do, right?
I see. Very fascinating. So what we know is that detachment of Azerbaijan from the West further as part of the Russian. But what you're telling me about this interesting point, does the Turkish endgame also involve, having the declining economy, deep economic crisis in Turkey? Does it involve also deeper energy cooperation with Azerbaijan, some other expectations with the wealth that Azerbaijan, whatever it is, has for Turkey?
Obviously, and that comes in two ways. Number one, it could come in the way of more purchases of weaponry from Turkey, and that's good money, you know, to get those Bayraktars and other NATO-level equipment, whether it's night goggles or, you know, whatever. These are quite expensive, and Turkey has made a lot of money out of that. Then they already have the pipelines. So on by what price do they get what they get? And maybe more investments. So these are quite likely outcomes that are more practical as
far
as...
What can Azerbaijan offer Turkey?
I'm sorry?
What can Azerbaijan offer Turkey in return? I mean, in terms of gas or other...
Well, cheaper gas, cheaper oil. These are certainly, but also a deeper presence in the region. And that would be like checkmating both Russia and Iran. So for Turkey, it's a success story, as opposed to Libya, for example, as opposed to northern Syria. But this is a real live success story.
Tangible success. Also, the former generals such as İlker Başbuğ, former chief of staff, who repeated his earlier statement that his dream, reflecting, I think, many of his co-officers' expectations that Turkey and Azerbaijan build a confederation. So this was part of the, I think, part of the scheme.
Well, I think there's a very complex relationship between Azerbaijan and Turkey. On the other hand, on one hand, Turkey has been extremely helpful in the past and certainly during this war and in preparation for the war. But on the other hand, Azerbaijan does not want to be treated as the kid or the younger brother. And at times there have been tensions between Azerbaijan and Turkey. When Turkey has decided that it will tell Azerbaijan what to do. And this goes back to the 90s, and this also applies to Central Asia, when the Central Asian Turkic Republics, the Soviet Union collapsed, Turkey had this vision of recreating some kind of a virtual empire. And the United States, not knowing Central Asia at all and knowing the South Caucasus little, they knew European republics a little bit, former Soviet republics, thought they could attract Azerbaijan and Central Asian republics by offering Turkey as an example of a Muslim country that was democratic, that was secular, but Muslim populated, right? And Turkey was pushed in that direction. But at the end, the Central Asian republic said, okay, you know, we can take care of ourselves. Mm. We've got resources. We can stand up on our own. And so Turkey's influence was not as much as they wanted to be. Azerbaijan is a little different because historically, not geographically, they have been closer. Historically and intellectually, there have been affinities. Azerbaijani intellectuals have defined Azerbaijani nationalism in many ways similar to that in Turkey during the Young Turks. Those affinities are stronger than those with Central Asia. So Azerbaijan is maybe closer. And the idea of two nations, two republics, one nation has come and gone. But Azerbaijan, I do not think, will want to be completely absorbed by Turkey. So I don't know if they will go that far as to have a confederation. I think it may have the same problem as the United Arab Republic of the late 50s between Egypt and Syria.
Right. This comes to mind easily.
Yeah, so it lasted 2-3 years, but it went. And, you know, I was born in Lebanon, and I was in Lebanon then as a student, and I would follow politics. I started reading newspapers when I was 9. You know, so I remember much more than I should. And I had been to Syria, not to Egypt, because our godfather was in Damascus. So as children, we would go there to be baptized in Damascus. And I don't remember my baptism. I do remember my younger sister's and my younger brother's baptism. Mm-hmm. And so it's I couldn't imagine, and I couldn't imagine that Syrians and Egyptians would get along that closely. At a little distance as cousins, yes, but as brother and sister, you know, it will not work. So I think there will be a problem as far as that is concerned.
Jirair, another important component of this war that we witnessed, which I think the casualties are more than 6,000, maybe more, killed many people, many suffering, many families suffering, of course. But the important component was Turkey's export, apparent export of jihadist mercenaries to the war. Where do this element fit in now that the ceasefire agreement is there? What will happen with those? Will Turkey willingly take them back, or what will happen?
Well, this is an Azerbaijani problem now, and to some extent Turkish problem. It's no longer an Armenian problem. As long as the war stopped and they don't come into Karabakh, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if Azerbaijan will want these jihadists in. My understanding is that they are, many of them were very religious, if they are jihadists. And although Azerbaijan is a Muslim society,
it's a Shia society.
It's not just Shia, but it is much more secular than they want. And there have been clashes with the local population. There will be a problem. It will be a problem for Azerbaijan. Also a problem for Russia if these guys decide that they want to infiltrate into Russia. When, you know, Chechnya, Dagestan, Ingushetia, you have their issues, or also Iran, you know. So there will be, I think, a general willingness to get rid of these people. They will not want them in. And a lot of these are married people. They have children in Syria. So I'm not sure. I really don't know enough to guess as to what will happen. But I do not think that they will be welcome once the war is over. Now, Azerbaijan may want to keep them for a while, and Turkey may want to keep them for a while, just in case Armenians decide they don't like the ceasefire anymore. Mm-hmm. And I guess both Turkey and Azerbaijan and Russia are watching carefully what's happening in Armenia, because the demand for the prime minister's resignation are very high. The demand for him to go and to be replaced by some coalition of forces is strong. But Pashinyan today said that I'm not going anywhere. I'm the prime minister. I'm staying. And this is my plan to recover. Now, I think that will be a disastrous thing for Armenia to have Pashinyan continue.
Think so?
I think he doesn't understand what happened. Okay,
that's what I wanted to know, because you are the one of the very few people who predicted this outcome, that there would be an outburst of a conflict sooner than later, and it happened. And the loser, we talked about the winners, but the loser is basically Armenia. Everyone says that. So please go on and share us with your view.
You see, the problem, as I formulate it, is not Pashinyan, although there's a personal dimension to the question as to what does this ceasefire, this agreement represent, and what is there for the future. It in every such crisis, the personality matters. Whether it's the US, in Russia, how do you handle difficulty? How do you handle defeat? How do you handle a crisis? And Pashinyan is the kind that apparently will not leave, not willingly anyway. And constitutionally, he has the right until the next parliamentary election. Now, But the problem is not him. Let's say he goes. And let's say Armenia has a new government that has representatives of all the political parties. But except for Derbedrosyan's party, everyone else was in line with Pashinyan's strategy. And you don't see a critique of the Pashinyan strategy on that basis. The critique is in the execution. The war could have been conducted better, right? That's the line. But in my view, that's not the problem. Some of the opposition now want to tear up that ceasefire. And if you tear up that ceasefire, you lose everything. Everything within a week. Okay?
And Putin just said that today,
yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. You will lose everything. So that's very obvious. It's not over yet. If Armenians continue, if he is replaced by the Tashnaks, by the Republican Party, by the Lusavor Hayastan, etc. These guys have all been in line with the kind of mentality which I summarize as this. In our administration, under Derbedrosyan, we were taking our chances with peace. Okay? Subsequently, and particularly with Pashinyan, he was taking chances with war. Okay? This is
That's
the fundamental
difference.
As if Armenia had a choice, war or peace. We don't get peace as we want it, then we go to war, right? This mentality was not critiqued by any of the parties except Derbedrosyan and myself and a few others like me, saying this is not the way to go, because this will lead to war, and wars are unpredictable, and the longer you wait for the war, the less chances you have of having another victory. This is as simple as that. So we wanted to take chances with peace. Now, it had risks. Do you trust Azerbaijan? Do you this or this? No one trusts anyone. Azerbaijan doesn't trust us. So that wasn't the question. But we believe, and I personally believe as a historian and as a diplomat, that what you say and do counts. That the way Azerbaijan and Turkey reacted, at least partially, is in response to the way we talked and the way we behaved. That it is not independent of us. That we can impact the behavior of Azerbaijan and Turkey. And this was proven in the 90s. Although we defeated Azerbaijan at the time, and Turkey said no bilateral relations because of that, because of Qarabağ, we still maintained discussions, relations, not diplomatic, but through diplomats with Turkey and with Azerbaijan. We were trying to find ways of doing it.
True.
But since then, it has become, Kocharyan tried something that was unrealistic. Then Serge tried at the end, he started thinking very seriously, but he didn't have time to finish. I don't know if he would have made the deal. So they thought that they had the time to consolidate. Pashinyan was convinced that ceasefire would continue. And then he went into his populist mood and then became a factor that brought war closer and a harsher war. So
Armenia would not have perhaps come out with so many losses if it had acted earlier, maybe by giving two or three rayons
Absolutely. I don't think look, this is the reality now. If we had gone with peace and returned those territories, let's say with special conditions with regard to Lachin and to some extent Kelbajar, but by through negotiations and understandings. For example, I had proposed to my friend Guluzadeh that with regard to Lachin, we do the following. It is Azerbaijan, but we need it. They don't need it as much as we do. So why don't you lease it to us? You are a rich country, I said. Lease it to us for $1 a year for 99 years. You know? It's still yours.
Right.
And I had another proposal, too, with regard to Lachin. You know, I said, maybe you give us Lachin or you give it to Garapa, but Garapa gives you an equivalent amount of territory from somewhere in the former autonomous region. Okay? I mean, there are ways of imagining solutions that takes into consideration territorial integrity, but also interests.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if we had some kind of an agreement, if, let's say, the September 97 proposal under De Bedrosian, which we accepted as a basis for negotiations, and Baku was likely to accept, if that had been implemented, but then Azerbaijan attacked anyway, right? We would have ended up where we are now, except without all the dead, the new generation that is gone.
Right.
Now, with chance, when you, so this is the worst that could have happened. But when you take chances with war, this is the best that can happen.
Mm.
You can't expect anything better than this.
Let's see.
So I, in my view now, it is the mentality that matters. And I'm not that interested as to who comes in, but whether we will now... You see, there are two ways of interpreting this ceasefire agreement. The pessimistic way, and it's a legitimate way, is that it's over. Okay? It's over. The Garapa conflict is over. The status issue is now up to Azerbaijan, not up to Armenians. And the rest is detail. This is one interpretation of the ceasefire agreement. And it is a legitimate interpretation. The other interpretation is that there's so much that's not clearly defined, that's so vague. There are still issues there. So there's room to negotiate, and it's a dynamic document. So it depends on what you do now as Armenia.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is true, if there is room to wiggle, then the question is, how do we approach these negotiations? If we approach it with the same mentality that we did before, we are doomed. There's nothing that will remain.
You will continue to lose.
Yeah. I mean, how many times can you repeat a strategy that has failed, right? That has led you to failure.
Mm.
And you tried again expecting victory out of it or success. It doesn't work that way. We know that didn't work, that hasn't worked. It hasn't worked during the First Republic. It is not working now. And it will not work. So that's my concern.
I see.
Because if the others come, I don't care. I mean, it's not... the others are more corrupt anyway, right? The Tashnaks were corrupt. The Republicans were corrupt. Serge's people were corrupt. This guy, personally, I don't think he's corrupt. And there's much less corruption now in Armenia.
Mm-hmm.
And if they come, it is... You see, the others have an interest in coming back to power because Pashinyan was getting closer and closer to many of the oligarchs, including Serge, and he had put in prison, or justice had put in prison, Kocharyan, right? And he's out because of COVID. He's not out otherwise.
Yes.
So, and Serge Sargsyan is charged with the money issues. So, and Zarugyan, the Parkavac Prosperous Armenia Party, he was in prison, you know. So these guys have very personal interests in all of this, and they are loaded.
Right.
There are billionaires. Kocharyan is a billionaire. Serge Sargsyan is a billionaire. Pashinyan has nothing. De Bedrosian has no money in the bank. You know?
Jurair, I have one final question. In my previous interview, Tom Duval, whom you know, the author of Black Garden, we analyzed the situation as the conflict deepened. He argued that now that Kelbecer is to be handed over to Azerbaijan. Kelbecer was the main reason that Turkey closed its borders with Armenia. Right. Now that this, let's say, obstacle is gone, or pretext is gone, or reason is gone, he argued that in a post-Erdogan era, this makes it Armenian-Turkish rapprochement possible. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's possible, but it depends on two things. First, I don't think it can be done immediately, but in some future...
He talks about post-Erdogan era, of course.
Right. Well, it's not just post-Erdogan.
Post-Bahçeli as well.
Well, no, even if Erdogan is gone tomorrow, it doesn't mean that on January we can have the border open. The feelings are too high. I don't think Armenians will want to see the border open.
You don't think so?
Because now we hate Turks more than we did before. Mm. So why would we open the border? Before, there was some opposition. There were some concerns. But now the feelings are very raw, and it has not been, and there's no discourse. Although I'm surprised a number of my friends raised that issue, they think in a reverse way, now that the Karabakh issue is more or less resolved, can we at least deal with Turkey? Okay. What I think must happen is, again, we have to have a government that thinks differently about neighbors, that does not begin the process of thinking about neighbors as enemies, but that neighbors are neighbors. Our policy was to normalize relations with everyone, including resolving the conflict of Karabakh. And that long term, that is the security a country has. You don't leave any problems unresolved between you and your neighbors. But if the mentality remains, that is, the hatred is the dominant. Hatred and fear, interestingly, are the dominant feelings, and the feelings have not been processed. True. The feelings become the basis of strategy. I'm one of the introductions to one of my volumes. I have a whole section on fear as strategy in Armenian political thinking. So I think we need, during this war, in fact, I sent word to Pashinyan. That on many issues, this is not something I should discuss. But we need new, even with Erdogan, we need to establish contacts. One official from Karabakh I spoke to said, and I said, establish contact with Aliyev. And this official said, but what would I have to talk with him? I said, do you have a problem with Aliyev? Yes, then that's what you talk.
True.
We have to
There's always a reason.
We have to end this thing of talking through Russia or the US or anyone. You talk to your enemies directly.
If right? You can, of course.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. There's no other way. And I know that negotiating does not mean that you meet and you sit and say, this is what I want. No, I won't give it to you. Thank you very much. You're bad. I'm simplifying it, but that's not negotiation. Negotiation, particularly with neighbors, you're not negotiating with Zimbabwe. You're not negotiating with far off Australia.
Yeah.
You are negotiating with peoples who are next to you and countries that are next to you. You have to understand them. You have to understand why they say no to something.
Now,
and you have to explain honestly why you want something. It may or may not produce something, but at least there's a confidence that you're not dealing with the enemy. You're dealing with your neighbor, and you understand their problem. This morning, I was explaining to my wife as to why Shushi is important to Azerbaijanis, how much it is part of their culture, right? It bothers me that it is, but I can't stop knowing that it is. So when we did things in Shushi, for them, Shusha was being violated. And now they take Shusha and they do things which, in our view,
there are deep concerns about violations, upcoming violations.
We really have to stop this. And regardless as to whether something survives of Armenian Qarabağ, as I've said before, in 1988, when the Tashnak leader said, we can't be independent, Armenia cannot be independent. Because he said, I went to Gyumri, I looked at Turkey, this vast country, right? And, you know, they will come and kill us if we're independent. This is what he said. They'll continue the genocide. And I wrote a piece, said at the time, now, if that is true, then we will never be independent. Right? So, and the Tashnaks were the ones who were most crazy about independence during Soviet period. Now they're saying, no, we're afraid we cannot be. And I wrote the following. And I sent word to this guy. And I said the following. What are the chances, mathematically, that Turkey will pack up its bags, go somewhere else, and Switzerland will come as our neighbor? What are the mathematical chances? Okay? You either find a way to talk with them.
Yes.
Or you pack up your bags and go.
Go.
Saying, I don't like this spot, and I'm going to go somewhere else as an Armenian, right? I mean, this is, it's a very simple thing in my mind.
Correct. Well, it's been quite many minutes we talked about it, this issue. I hope we can come back to it again with you. Wonderful, fascinating analysis, tour d'horizon with you, Jirayr. My guest was today Jirayr Libaridyan, a former deputy minister of foreign affairs of Armenia, former senior advisor to then President Levonter Petrosyan, now based in Boston, Massachusetts. Great historian and politician. Thank you for this conversation, Jirayr.
Thank you, Yavuz, for the opportunity, and good to see you again.
See you too.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.